Dear colleagues, before going to before starting the presentation of the Ulrich Teichler keynote, let me just give a welcome to all of you. This will be a very short introductory speech. Let me say this hopefully for the last time. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night, and good evening. Because hopefully next time we're all going to be together in the same place, in the same time zone. But it's great to see many familiar faces, names, and profile photos, and also some new faces, names, and profile photos that I think attest to a meeting of established and younger generations of higher education researchers in Europe and beyond. I am hopeful that in this conference, novel findings can be shared and new collaborations formed. The program is quite promising, and I'm sure it will provide fertile ground for both collaborations and for new knowledge to be disseminated. So let's make us this online conference the continuation of a journey to form a higher education community that is dynamic, that includes people from all over the world. And then in the future, hopefully we can return in person to beautiful Finland for some other chair conference. So I want to end this introduction by thank you all for being here, and a special thanks to the organizers of the conference, because without their work and their organization, this conference would have not been possible. Okay, having said that, if you don't mind, I will hop then to the introduction of the Ulrich Teichler keynote. So this is a keynote that represents a deserved acknowledgement to one of the founders of CHAIR. Ulrich has been an unrelenting driving force of higher education studies in Europe and in the world. He's an accomplished researcher, an inspiration that brought new knowledge on a wide range of topics to the field, but also contributed to the legitimacy of the field among scholarly communities and policymaking circles. His importance is tremendous. I do not have to enumerate the massive number of publications, presentations, and other activities that he organized and participated in. It suffices to say that his ideas, conceptualizations, and actions continue to influence our work today with as much impact as they did before. We usually say that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and Ulrich is certainly one of the giants of higher education research. The honor of being the first keynote speaker rightly befell on Yusif Alima, a professor of higher education, an historian at art, and not only of higher education, but also a political scientist and a comparativist, someone with deep knowledge of European policymaking, societies, cultures, and economies. He's also a humanist and a friend that has generated a tremendously meaningful body of research and knowledge. And today we have the pleasure to listen to. His keynote is titled, How Higher Education Changes. Let us hear about it. Yusi, the floor is yours.
thank you, Hugo, very much for your kind words. This is really an honor for me to have the first Ulrich Teichler keynote. And it's especially honor because it's really hard to find any person or any academic who would have had a greater impact and importance for the development of European higher education research than Professor Ulrich Teichler. In the United States, I would call him my dear friend, but we are not in the United States, we are in Europe. So I call Ulrich my good colleague, primus inter pares, best among our colleagues. So this keynote will focus on, and I will reflect on, one of the core processes of and in higher education chains. I hope I can convince you that it is indeed one of the core processes in higher education. I will start by discussing change as a concept and a phenomenon. Then I will continue by discussing how societies change and how this societal change has been explained. Then I will analyze change in the field of higher education research. And in my keynote, with reflecting on some possible future perspectives. Being a historian as an original training, I will not have any slides. So you have to look at, you can look at me or just shut down the screen. Change is one of the main challenges and problems and processes in higher education for many actors or stakeholders, if you prefer that concept, in the field of higher education. First, it's a challenge for politicians and policymakers who would like to reform higher education systems. It's also a challenge for university leadership who would like to restructure or reform the organizations. For these actors, the need for change actually has been used and is used as an argument to start reforms and restructurings of higher education institutions and higher education systems. As we noted in a study with Professor Taina Saarinen, higher education policy is legitimated with a continuous need for change. But the question is, whose view of change becomes the dominant one? This is also one of the reasons why change is a challenge for us higher education researchers, if and when we would like to understand and explain how and why higher education changes. In our field, over decades, there can be found a number of studies aiming to explain and analyze what causes changes and what are the consequences of changes in higher education systems and higher education institutions. There have been published many studies analyzing major reforms of higher education systems, analysis of university mergers, studies of institutional transformations, analysis of trends of global and international changes, and critical studies on a number of smaller and bigger crises in higher education. Indeed, to an extent that Malcolm Tait in 1994 asked, crisis, what crisis? Rhetoric and reality in higher education. He listed top 10 books in the United Kingdom and top 20 books in the United States published between years 1949 and 1993. This number of publications has increased significantly after that. I made a small calculation in one journal, Higher Education, and counted that so far in this year, they have been published 8 articles dealing with different kind of changes in higher education. And it seems that the COVID-19 pandemic is an emerging topic, and the changes caused by the pandemic are really interesting, are of interest to our field and researchers. But what is, as a social phenomenon, change may be approached from a number of intellectual perspectives. Philosophically speaking, change has been on the Western intellectual agenda from the times of classical Greek philosophers. Heraclitus noted that we and not we step into and do not step into the same rivers 2 times, because everything is in flux. Pantarei, everything flows. Aristotle, in turn, defined change as a process which has a beginning and an end, and one may see a difference between the beginning and the end. This philosophical notion is actually quite fruitful for us as researchers, because it provides an intellectual perspective to understand change as a process which may have different directions. The process of change can lead to improvements like evolution, progress, reform, or it may result in decay, decline, deterioration, collapse, or crisis. So I would like to encourage you, my dear colleagues, to be quite careful and precise when we speak about different forms and directions of change. Every reform is not an improvement. The Aristotelian perspective is a useful reminder for us academics because we are living in an environment, academia and university, where the idea of continuous change is embedded in the goals of teaching and learning and research processes. Education and learning, I'd like to say, is all about developing human minds. In other words, changing students' thinking. However, in this keynote, I will not focus on pedagogical perspectives to teaching and learning, even though they are important, but take support from social sciences. Because social science studies help to open seminal perspectives to reflect on changes in higher education as a social institution as an organization. Indeed, my argument is that higher education has these two dimensions. Higher education is both an institution and an organization. Then, well, it's an institution and organization. What do I mean by that? Concerning institution, I follow the definition of Streeck and Thelen from 2005, who say that institutions are building blocks of social order. This is a very short definition. But as institutions, higher education takes care of creating and transmitting new knowledge, values, and intellectual perspectives to new generations. To put it very shortly, the main goals of higher education as an institution are the search for truth and the education of new generations into citizens and professionals. This kind of social institution of higher education can be found in every organized society. Or to put it another way, it is hard to describe any society who would not have this social institution. Organizations, in turn, exist to achieve goals, as Lunenburg puts it. In order to fulfill their goals, organizations have formal structures and administrative or managerial processes. Organizations also consist of different groups of people with different, often conflicting interests and goals, especially in higher education, in higher education institutions. And this makes all organizations, including universities, as political entities where power is exercised, challenged, decisions made, executed, and resisted. The political nature of higher education, together with their different national, cultural environments, and economic resources, also mean that there can be found a rich variation among organizational structures of higher education institutions and national systems of higher education. Well, when saying this, you can see that I locate myself in the intellectual tradition where I see that higher education institutions are as part of their societies and consequently tied with the social and political changes taking place in their respective societies. But the question then arises, how do societies change? Aristotelian perspective to change is helpful in reflecting on this question. Approaching the question from Aristotelian perspective, we can argue that grand sociological theories or macro sociological theories, if you prefer that concept, they are really theories of social change of societies. In what follows, I will take support from the study we conducted with Taina Saarinen in 2012. Social historian Peter Burke defined two main traditions in explaining social change. These are theories of modernization and theories of crisis and conflict. In theories of modernization, the central conceptualization is social evolution, as opposed to revolution. And in this social evolution, society develops gradually and cumulatively. And internal as opposed to external factors steer the development of society in the direction of structural differentiation. In this theoretical tradition, change is an internal process where the external world offers impulses which stimulate the individual systems into adapting into new equilibrium. Hence, they are also called balance theories. However, when emphasizing the internal nature of change, models of modernization may give an impression of unproblematic unilinearity, as if change were an automatic sequence of stages. Peter Burke gives some examples of these modernization theories. These include Spencer, Durkheim, Weber, and Parsons, for example. An alternative, or rather opposite to the theories of modernization, is provided by theories of conflict or coercion. According to these theories, society is, in a historical perspective, is seen as a series of societies following each other discontinuously. Societies and their development are defined by economic systems or modes of production, which contain internal contradictions. These lead to conflict, crisis, and discontinuous change. Change is, in other words, dialectic. I think it's a surprise to nobody that Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Lukács, and Gramsci are examples of this tradition, according to Peter Burke. Well, what does this mean for social research, including Heideggerian research? In the modernization theories, the focus is on forces and processes that keep the society together, on forces which produce integration, differentiation, and balance. Society is looked as a developing organ, a constant structure or a combination of structures where each component participates in sustaining the whole. Change does take place also in these systems, but it is in its different aspects, both incremental, evolutionary, and cumulative. Whereas the conflict tradition is represented by the idea of societal change taking place suddenly in the forms of crisis and conflict. However, both these traditions of theories can include both internal and external pressures to change. This very brief shortcut to selection of macro-sociological theories aims to say that, first, that there are many kinds of social changes, and secondly, that social change may be approached from different intellectual perspectives. The impetuses for social change may be related either to internal or external factors, or a combination of both internal and external factors. External factors in the context of higher education may refer to societal pressures for change, whether these be political, cultural, or economic, or arising from civic society, whereas internal refers to academic and intellectual pressures, where main impulses are related to increasing research and theoretical understanding. Historically speaking, higher education has been and is part of their societies and their changes. However, higher education is a case of its own, mainly for two reasons. First one is the fact that as a social institution, higher education is characterized by continuity, which in itself is not a typical element in societies. As an institution, higher education has a strong continuity in Europe extending from the Middle Ages to the 21st century. One of the factors contributing to this continuity is the fact that the cornerstones of medieval European universities are continuously alive and relevant for contemporary universities. According to university historians, these continuities and these corners are the following ones. They were, so historians have defined these cornerstones from the universities of the 12th century and earlier 13th century. And these include belief in the dignity of man. In other words, there is conviction that students can be taught and that they can grow and mature during their studies. A second one is a conviction that there exists a universe that is open for rational reasoning. In other words, empirical and theoretical research helps to understand nature and human beings. The third one is belief that man can master his environment with the help of knowledge and experience. Fourth one is the belief, or actually is the practice, that universities encourage critical thinking and analytical approach. This actually is one of the reasons why universities have been able to develop intellectually and integrate new disciplines into their structures. Fifth one is maybe the most important. There has been an emphasis on publicity of research and open debates from the very beginning. So this is what historians say that are the cornerstones. If you think about your universities, your higher education institutions, are these principles still relevant for your university? If they are, so then you and we belong to the tradition of European universities. As organizations, however, universities and other higher education institutions have met with many organizational changes. Often these changes have taken place in relation to or as a consequence of changes in society. I give you a few historical examples to illustrate my argument. First example is the establishment of grandes écoles in France. They were established after the French Revolution to train civil servants for the French Republic and states that followed. The second one is provided by the emergence of technical universities in Europe during the 19th century as a reaction to and a support of industrial revolution in Europe. Massification of higher education after the Second World War, in turn, helps to show how the needs of industrial and post-industrial societies have created socio-economic and political pressures to expand higher education to respond to changing societal, industrial, and commercial needs. So now you may be thinking that will I ever get into higher education research? Yes, I will. So how to analyze changes in higher education research? I have quite much referred to historical studies so far, but this is too one-sided, since higher education research is by nature multidisciplinary. Change in relation to policy issues and problems can be studied from a variety of disciplinary viewpoints, because research problems are often theme-based, as already Ulrich Streichler has noted. A close relationship between the changes in societies and organizational forms in higher education has influenced higher education research as well. One of the trends in European higher education research has been policy implementation studies, which have aimed to examine what has happened or is happening in higher education in relation to or a consequence of local, national, and regional policies. There are a number of studies on that. This research strategy starts from the assumption that external pressures force higher education to change. There are a number of such studies analyzing changes in higher education as national case studies or a comparative research set, or in a comparative research setting. Both of these studies are needed because as researchers, we need to understand, we have to conceptualize and theorize what is actually happening in higher education. These studies have been especially popular and important during the periods of great reforms during the 1960s and 70s, and more recently in relation to Bologna process in Europe. Another perspective to study and explain change in higher education is to analyze internal academic processes taking place in science and scholarship. Internal academic processes create, in turn, pressure for higher education institutions to change. This argument can be found already in the classical study by Burton Clark, The Higher Education System, Academic Organization in Cross-National Perspective, from already 1983. Clark defines change both widely, meaning the birth of a national education system in a society, and narrowly, the changes within that educational system. For Clark, change is a continuum which includes, I quote, alterations that vary from simple reproduction to radical transformation. Both the need for change as well as its obstacles are integrated within the system. Therefore, change becomes possible when higher education systems' internal mechanisms start to steer the cumulative change in the system driven by the increase of new knowledge. This creates new disciplines, research fields, leading to demands for new chairs and curricula. This will lead in turn to new organizational forms, departments, research laboratories and institutes, and so forth. In Clark's view, this kind of bottom heaviness of higher education system defines change. Therefore, bottom heavy academic organizations can change only gradually, and change is for the most part invisible. Another tradition to study changes in higher education are the policy implementation studies. A very good example of critical policy implementation studies is provided by studies by Kogan, Bauer, Blakely, and Henkel, transforming higher education from the year 2000. They analyzed policy change as a structural question and as a question of human action in three countries, Great Britain, Norway, and Sweden. And their perspective is field of social action. According to them, field is an institutionalized area of activity in which actors struggle about something that is of importance to them. They do not define what is important for each field, but they recognize that they struggle for something that is important to them. What is essential and interesting in their thinking is that reforms are not a result of top-down or bottom-up implementation process, which has been a typical approach from the 1960s to the 1990s. But they argue that the processes are where each level interprets in their own way the general policy goals, because each field of social action is different and there takes place different struggles in each field. It's also important that the relationship between fields are not necessarily hierarchic, but rather communicative, where actors in different fields make their own interpretations during the struggles in the field. In addition to this, I would like to call them classical studies. There have been found a number of theories and schools of thought that are helpful in analyzing how higher education changes. In other words, the difference between the beginning and the end of the courses. One of the quite popular ones has been the new institutional theory. I will refer shortly the main ideas of new institutional theory to sharpen my argument. DiMaggio and Power from 1983 explain why organizations in a given organizational field, such as higher education, tend to become more homogeneous over time instead of staying different from each other. They use the concept of isomorphism to describe the process of homogenization with the help of three different mechanisms, coercive, mimetic, and normative. They stem from different sources. Coercive isomorphism stems from political influence and the problems of legitimacy. These pressures may be both formal and informal, and exerted by other organizations or by society's cultural expectations. Mimetic isomorphism results from standard responses to uncertainty, which is a both powerful force that encourages imitation. Organizations may also model themselves after other organizations to reduce uncertainty. And normative isomorphism is in turn often associated mainly with professionalism, which is the collective struggle of members of an occupation to define the conditions and methods of their work. So in short, for DiMaggio and Powell, change is something that happens inside an organization as a result of external pressures. However, new institutionalism is not a monolithic research approach. There have been Hall and Taylor divided it into three main schools of thought: rational choice, historical, and sociological institutionalism. Rational choice is rooted in rational choice theory, which assumes that factors are rational and therefore make decisions in terms of their utility. One of the theoretical approaches utilized in rational choice institutionalism is agent theory, which aims to describe agency relationships where one entity, the principal, delegates work to another entity, the agent, who performs that work. However, as Professor Jussi Kivinen has shown, this approach does not fit well with Heidegger's research because it does not capture well the wide range of other than economic aspects influencing government-university relationships. Historical institutionalism, in turn, explains Heidegger's institutions with the help of their history. Most historical institutionalists see that Heidegger's institutions are path-dependent, meaning that contemporary decisions are limited by choices and decisions made in the past. And indeed, path dependence perspective is helpful in explaining why policy continuity is more probable than policy change. Another perspective is resource dependency theory, which aims to analyze the rationale on how organizations make active and rational choices to manage their dependency on those parts of the environment that control vital resources. So this historical analysis helps to understand why certain goals, policies, ideas, and so forth are emphasized over others, and why there are different national responses to similar challenges. According to this school of thought, a culture, society, and organizational identity are important for the institutions, and therefore on behavior of their actors. Heidegger's institutions are therefore not only affected by strategic calculations and of individuals, but also their basic preferences and identity. In sociological institutionalism, institutions are defined broadly, including not only rules, procedures, and norms, but also the symbols, cognitive schema, and moral patterns that guide human action, establishing a systemic relationship between individuals and institutions. Sociological and historical institutionalisms pay attention to the context, which help to shape policy change, mediate between actors, and alter conditions in which decisions are made. Sociological institutionalism also emphasizes the importance of a structure over agency. From a sociological perspective, culture is one of the most important driving forces behind the institutionalization of human behavior. However, this new institutionalism has also been criticized as a theoretical framework because there are problems in explaining the connections between organizational context and organizations' internal social dynamics. This makes new institutional theoretically weak for analyzing internal dynamics of organizational change because it does not help to understand and explain, for example, why some higher education institutions implement radical changes, whereas others do nothing, despite the fact that they have experienced the same institutional pressures. According to Björn Stensaker, change is indeed one of the most problematic matters in different variations of new institutionalism. So in order to understand organizations and higher education institutions' internal dynamics, there is a need to study higher education institutions as a cultural environments and cultural entities that have multiple aims, goals, and values. The approaches of disciplinary cultures and organizational cultures are therefore useful as intellectual devices and perspectives, because they aim to reveal different rationalities and communities functioning inside higher education institutions. Well, now I feel like being a schoolmaster, explaining my students the things they already know. I apologize for that. But I think that it's important to have an overview on different intellectual and theoretical traditions aiming to explain what social forces and cultural, economic, and political context may influence on higher education and changes taking place in them. So, how to explain academically the driving forces, dynamics, and processes of change? I tend to think Sven Jurvik, who argued that as higher education researchers, we need to apply more than one theoretical perspective to explain the phenomena of change in higher education. I would say that it's helpful to use eclectic research strategies. As Sven Jurvik notes, none of the potential theories is enough in itself when explaining the processes of change in higher education. Jurvik explained in his book Changes in Norwegian non-university sector with the help of three types of explanations. These are structural, cultural, and interest group approaches. I do not have time to explain them in details here, but it's important to note that as researchers, we need to utilize a combination of different perspectives and theoretical lenses, because there are always many actors, motivations, and expected and unexpected outcomes that influence on the dynamics of change processes in higher education institutions. These can be both external forces and impulses of internal processes of change, or unexpected combinations of both external and internal influences that make higher education institutions to change. So have I answered my question, or the question of the title of the presentation so far? I think I have not. I think there are at least two more perspectives that need to be taken into account when thinking about how higher education changes. First comes the fact that social responsibilities of higher education as an institution and as an organization mean that higher education has a strong political potential to change societies. And this is maybe the main reason why politicians are and have always been very interested in influencing and changing higher education institutions. And for the same reason, higher education research has been interested in knowing what actually happens inside higher education institutions. What are the processes of change, and what are the motivations of the relevant groups or actors or stakeholders? Pick the concept that you like. In short, as researchers, we are interested in understanding how higher education can change societies and how higher education has changed societies. Traditionally, higher education research has been maybe too much interested in asking how societies have changed higher education. Therefore, I even dare to suggest that we should expand our research approach. Instead of analyzing high education as an object of societal actions, we should ask how high education changes societies. In other words, we should analyze high education as subjects in changing societies, not objects. Why? Why is that? Because I would like to argue that high education changes only in interaction with the world. This means that high education has a great potential to change the world. But we should be faithful to the traditions of critical thinking and open debate. Bearing this in mind, high education institutions are unique social places in societies because they have the potential to act as meeting places for different members of societies, including non-governmental organizations, businessmen and enterprises, political leaders, and citizens. Because academics have wide internal, national, global networks. In addition, higher education institutions have organizational and technological infrastructures that help to organize debates and open social meetings in civil societies to exchange ideas. Higher education institutions have a potential to influence surrounding societies, both economically and socially. And what is often forgotten is the fact that higher education institutions can have a strong cultural influence in and on their respective societies. This argument brings me close to the theme of this conference. What is a sustainable and responsive higher education? I would like to say that as higher education researchers, we should feel social responsibility for our societies and mankind. By this, I refer not only to Russian brutal attack to Ukraine, but also to current climate crisis. The future of mankind very much depends on our capability to find solutions to ecological, social, and climate crises we are facing now and in the future. One would say that researchers have done their share in explaining politicians, business people, and citizens what is ahead of us. But it's the politicians that have not done their job. Even though this may be true, it's not the truth. We should do more to help higher education institutions, higher education systems, societies, in other words, mankind, to change and change more quickly, even though change is not easy. The only thing we must not lose is hope for a better future. Thank you.